WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is All of It. I'm Carrie Nolan, in for Allison Stewart. Now, depending on where you fall on the entertainment spectrum, you may know my next guest as a guitarist in Bruce Springsteen's E Street Band, or consigliere Silvio Dante on The Sopranos, or Frank Tagliano on Lilyhammer. Or maybe you know him as the force behind Artist Against Apartheid, and the leader of his own band, the Disciples of Soul, and as a producer of records by everyone from Ronnie Spector to Southside Johnny and the Asbury Jukes. Well, he now adds author to his already impressive body of work. His new memoir is called Unrequited Infatuations. It's published by Hachette Books, and I am thrilled that it brings Stevie Van Zandt to All of It. Welcome, and thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure, Carrie. Good to talk to you.
When you were writing this book, did you ever just at any point just sit back and think to yourself, my God, I've done a lot?
Well, I was a little surprised by the 90s because, thinking back, I consider it a lost decade. and you know, when I actually saw what I what I was doing, I was impressed myself, but it was sort of the first decade where I didn't have any kind of plan. I didn't have any kind of mission. So it was kind of a bizarre time in my own mind, in my own memory. But, I went back and had my office put together some of my schedules from back then and my biographies that they would do from time to time, which had, you know, a lot of things that I was doing, and I was surprised to see how much there was in that decade. But
we'll go through some of it. It's an awful lot. I have to say, just on a personal level, I loved this book. It was such a great read. Thank you for that. I remember hearing you call rock and roll sacred noise. What do you mean by that?
That sounds like something I would have said. Well, for me, it was what other people regard as religion. I mean, it was as close to religion as it's going to get for me. Mm-hmm. And I was a very religious kid growing up. So I kind of transferred that, spiritual energy, if you will, to the rock and roll world. It was how I was, saved. For me, my life was saved by rock and roll. I had nowhere to fit in. The options that society was offering me were just not interesting to me, and mm-hmm. I didn't know what I was going to do. Suddenly, here comes the Beatles, and introduced this whole new world. And man, was that exciting! That was just it was a life-saving moment, and. And then most of what I've learned in life, at least in the early part of my life, came through rock and roll records, which happens to be one of the musical idioms, I think, that is best at communicating substance. I go into some detail in the book about the various subgenres and what they're best at.
Right.
But when it comes to rock music, I think there's something about rock that has in its DNA the ability to communicate substance, and that came from Bob Dylan, basically.
That's an interesting. Yeah, I was just thinking that it would be folk music with a much harder, louder beat. Is what rock, you know, also the influence of the blues, obviously. But yeah, I think you're right about Dylan.
And that's exactly what he brought. He brought the folk music and blues subject matter into the pop world.
Let's go back to the Jersey Shore, where I'm from as well. You and Bruce Springsteen circled each other for years on the Shore band circuit, and then you finally become bandmates. You helped build the E Street Band, and then just as the explosion of fame and money was about to happen, you walked away. I mean, who does that? You know, in the book you say, never leave your power base, not unless you've secured a new one. And you ignored your own advice. Why did you do that?
Oh, well, that's why the subtitle of the book adds, you know, it's a cautionary tale.
Right.
That's the caution right there. It wasn't that I was ignoring my own advice at that time. I was ignoring everybody else's advice, all of whom were just shocked and bewildered by my leaving.
Mm-hmm.
It's good, you know, it's good advice, by the way, but the time I just was, it was a perfect storm of a number of things happening simultaneously. I had become obsessed with politics. I was offered a record deal. Me and Bruce had a bit of a, our first real argument, you know,
mm-hmm.
one of the three we've had, all of which I talk about in great detail.
Right.
It was just an emotional moment, and I just felt compelled to move on at that moment. And I thought, in all of these years, really, thinking back, I thought I was, messing around with destiny and felt it was the biggest mistake of my life. But when I went back and really examined it, and what came after, I've now come to peace with the fact that it maybe wasn't messing with destiny so much as fulfilling destiny.
Now,
because everything I've done, really, everything I've accomplished since I left. So it was, it was interesting to relive that.
So you say in the book that there are two kinds of people in the world, band guys and solo guys. And you had always been a band guy, but now you find yourself kind of in the position of recreating yourself as a solo guy.
Mm.
Let's talk a little bit about that process.
Yeah, it was a process because that's just not my inclination. I've never really needed or wanted to be the front guy, to be in the spotlight. But growing up in the Renaissance, and I call the 60s the Renaissance period intentionally and I feel that when the greatest art being made is also the most commercial, mm-hmm. you find yourself in a Renaissance period. And during that Renaissance period, all of the artists had a very distinct identity. And even in the 70s, when our monoculture really did explode and fragment, even the hybrids of the 70s actually had to have an identity. So I was, since I had become obsessed with learning about the world and learning about politics, and I was gonna learn about it and write about it, I decided, well, that would be my identity. I'll be the political mm-hmm. guy. Nobody was doing it full time. There'd be occasional records here and there, and occasional, of course, rockers showing up at protests and things like that. But nobody was writing about it and doing it full time. So I thought, well, that'll be my identity. And once it hit me, once the import, once it really hit me what I had done, which was not just change jobs, but I ended my life really by leaving the band.
Right.
After 15 years of work, when it hit me on the plane to South Africa, I think it really helped me focus on what was before me, which happened to be the South African issue.
Right.
Which was just one of the 40 issues I had written down that I was studying. But it happened to be at that moment when I'm going there. And I think it helped energize me or focus me or, you know, whatever. It just was, it became, you know, the justification of my existence was, you know, accomplishing something politically. And that happened to be where I was. So, you know, that turned out to be valuable.
Yeah, absolutely. If you're just joining us, my guest is Stevie Van Zandt. His new memoir, Unrequited Infatuations, is out now. And we have loads to cover here. When you left the E Street Band and you had this political awakening, you went to Nicaragua where you got seriously schooled there. And then let's go back and talk a little bit more about going to South Africa. That was a really huge and really dangerous move for you.
Yeah, and at that point, I just...
Did you understand exactly what you were getting into, or were you feeling like, I'm going to go down here, I'm going to learn, I'm going to come back and you know, put this new knowledge to work?
Yeah, I mean, at that point, I was still an artist slash journalist. You know, I was learning about things and then turning them into stories because, you know, we live in a storytelling medium in the rock world, you know.
Right.
So you had to, you know, you had to take the information and then turn that into a story. But at that moment, and I made two trips to South Africa. The first one, you know, I was still kind of being open-minded and objective and just, you know, staying with the artist journalist thing. But the second trip, I decided I need to go deeper. And that's when I started getting into really dangerous territory. Because in order to really get the research done, I felt I had to do that and meet with the real serious guys and have them endorse my idea of how to win this war. And luckily, you know, on that plane ride to South Africa, I'd never been a very good flyer. I'd always been a very nervous flyer. I didn't like the turbulence. I didn't like that feeling. And I felt, as I realized my life had ended, all the fear in my body just suddenly left. It completely left my body. I mean, I just felt like completely fearless from that moment on, which, again, helped, you know, get into those kind of situations where I didn't care at all. You know, my feeling was like, what are they going to do, kill me? You know, do me a favor. You know, it's like that, you know. So, you know, I think it just happened to be all happening at that moment where, you know, I'm investigating South Africa. I've completely lost my fear, and I want to go as deep as I can go, because this is a life and death issue, and I wanted to make sure I was on the right side of it, and make sure I was speaking for the South African people, because you know, I'm not someone who takes these things lightly, you know. So I wanted to make sure it was. I was doing the right thing.
Let's talk a little bit about the influence that Boston-based journalist Danny Schechter had on you.
Extremely important. I mean, all four of us were equally important, the four musketeers of the Sun City Project. Without Danny, no one would have ever known about the project because, as I talk about in the book, most of my work personally, my personal work, has never been particularly marketed. Because I never had a manager, and that's the manager's main job, you know.
Right.
So, you know, I kind of made a joke about it in the book. You know, one thing after the other. You know, nobody heard it. Nobody heard it. you know, but the truth is that Danny Schechter was the main reason. He was like the main sort of publicist, if you will. Arthur Baker. It was his phone book. You know, without his phone book, there'd be three artists on it instead of 50, you know, it was all out of his phone book and his studio and his engineers and musicians. So Arthur Baker played a major role musically as a co-producer. And then Hart Perry videoed everything, or else no one would have ever seen it because nobody would have even heard it because radio wouldn't play it.
Right.
You know, ironically, it was too black for white radio and too white for black radio in our own country to show our own apartheid, of course.
So who twisted the arms at MTV?
Well, that was me personally. I went in and I met with them, and they were right in the middle of their war with the black community. They were trying to decide how much black music they could play. You know, I know it's hard to imagine now, but they were taking the rock, you know, the rock definition very, very literally, and you know, didn't really want to play black artists. They were fighting over Michael Jackson, and I just said, look, you know, there's more black artists in this video than you're going to need all the rest of this year. So this'll help, you know. And I convinced them to play the video, and I said, you know, get ahead of it. You know, look, why don't you for once get ahead of this issue rather than, you know, playing catch up. So, and luckily they really did embrace it, and BET also, you know, the black network, Black Entertainment Television Network, because that's the only way people heard it was by seeing it.
Yes, exactly. And BET played Sun City a lot, if my memory serves. How are you able to bring all these diverse musicians together to make that video?
Well, again, it was. Largely, you know, out of Arthur Baker's phone book. And then, you know, we got lucky with some things, you know, because there was a few really important people I went after, like Gil Scott-Heron. You know, I had to track him down, which took a lot of detective work because he was on the lam at the time. And I had to call a phone booth like at a certain time every week because, you know, he was on the run from, I forget, you know, the cops or somebody. And you know, with Miles Davis, I got very lucky because one of my old sound men happened to be his sound man at the time. And I happened to find him, and he had the courage to mention it to Miles because, you know, Miles was an extremely tough, scary character who people just didn't want to ask for anything. And he'd never done anything like this. Mm-hmm. But I just got lucky that it happened to be an issue that really, really bothered him. And when he walked in the studio, that's when I knew, you know, I was onto something at that point, you know, because everybody else I could conceive of coming, but he was a tough one. But that was, you know, and slowly, I mean, some were friends of mine, but mostly, you know, I really the main thing was, and we all agreed on this, I wanted to get this new thing called rap onto the record. And the industry was really looking down on it at the time and was hoping it would go away and really was not taking it seriously at all. And I just felt that this was an extremely important movement, you know, a whole new way that black artists were getting a chance to express themselves. And it was and they never had, you know. I had watched the war go on with Marvin Gaye and Berry Gordy. Mm-hmm. And that was a major breakthrough when he convinced him to, you know, release What's Going On.
Right.
You know, but generally speaking, you know, black artists were not encouraged to express themselves. I mean, and that was just a fact. And white artists were, you know, ever since it became an art form in the mid 60s, very obviously. Personal expression became part of the deal, you know, which, again, Bob Dylan introduced. But the white artists were expected to express themselves. That's the only way you were taken seriously. That was the only way you had any credibility, you know. Mm-hmm. And the black artists were absolutely, it was the opposite. So here comes these rappers, and I'm like, well, this is extremely healthy. This is a really good idea. I'm glad they're expressing themselves, and I want to support it. And we all felt that way, all four of us. And so we put them on, and a lot of the industry, a lot of friends of mine in the industry, big shots, were like, are you really putting Melly Mel next to Bob Dylan? You know?
Yes,
you
we putting, are.
You know, Run DMC, you know, next to, you know, Jackson Brown, and, you know, and I was like, yes, we are. You know?
My guest is Steve Van Zandt. His book, Unrequited Infatuations, is out. We're going to take a real quick break, and then we'll be back. This is All of It on WNYC. The This is All of It. I'm Carrie Nolan, in for Allison Stewart, and my guest is Stevie Van Zandt. His memoir, which is a really great read, is called Unrequited Infatuations. Steve, let's pivot a little bit and talk about Teach Rock. Your mission statement says, quote, "We empower teachers and engage students by using popular music to create interdisciplinary, culturally responsive education materials for all 21st century classrooms." How exactly do you do that?
Well, we have, I don't know how many now, over 250 lesson plans online, all for free, by the way, teachrock.org. I don't know how many teachers. I think it's about 40,000 teachers registered. We have dozens of partner schools now registered. The main goal, as that says, is to basically make sure that the arts is part of the DNA of the public education system. And we have found that it's an extremely effective way of teaching, not as art as a separate class or an after-school thing, but integrating art into the disciplines, into science, into math, you know, into engineering and technology, turning STEM into STEAM, you know, the basic curriculum that the government has endorsed. You know, we need to add the arts into that mix. And we have found that it's extremely effective. It changes the way the kids learn. I mean, they come to school with all of these gifts, Carrie. You know, they come with curiosity, they come with imagination, they come with instinct and emotion, you know. And what does school typically do is we just kind of ignore that or squash it or, you know, suppress it. And we give them a bunch of facts that they don't understand why these things are relevant. And we tell them, learn this now and someday you'll use it. And that's just not going to work for this generation. You know, we need a new methodology, and we think we have found one, you know, by engaging them on their own turf. You know, in this case, they're all into music. So right. That's really easy. You know, we just say, who are you listening to? You know, and you know, and they're going to say Beyonce. And we're going to say, well, she comes from a lady named Aretha Franklin. And Aretha Franklin comes from Detroit. We talk about Detroit. And she comes from the gospel church. We talk about the gospel church. She comes from, she got involved in civil rights. We talk about civil rights. And they're paying attention because it's on common ground. It's on something that they understand, you know? And that is a very, very big difference. And we just feel the arts, you know, solves a lot of the problems that's going to be, you know, they're going to run into later in life because, you know, we feel it teaches kids how to think rather than what to think. And that, I think, is a critical point. And we're you know, we're just beginning, but the results we're seeing already is just outstanding. And I think we could literally transform the education process if we get this thing, this concept, you know, disseminated, you know, enough, you know.
I think it's difficult sometimes for teachers to be able to integrate that kind of curriculum when, in a lot of ways, they're just being taught to teach to the test.
Uh-huh. That's exactly the point. I'm glad you brought that up. That's exactly what happened with the No Child Left Behind legislation. It eliminated all the arts classes, being replaced by this obsession with testing. So that's why we kind of focus on the junior high school. You know, we kind of, you know, we don't force it into the high school years because of their obsession with testing. And eventually, you know, someday some smart person in the education world is going to say, you know what, testing isn't learning, you know?
Right.
And what's really important in this world is learning, not testing. And you know, and that's going to take a minute, I realize. So we kind of work around it, you know? Mm-hmm. But yeah, that obsession with testing has taken over the high school years. So we fit it in wherever we can. I mean, I eventually want this to be at every grade level from kindergarten through college and every discipline in every school system. I mean, we're providing all of these tools and then teachers can, you know, use them as they see fit. But we have, you know, obviously lesson plans that they can follow. But we have video and music that's licensed worldwide. you know, that they can use. So just, you know, giving them the tools to do their job, basically.
Well, now, Teach Rock has partnered with Connecticut Governor Ned Lamont to bring that curriculum into Connecticut's public schools. Do you know how that's going?
Yeah, we can only go as fast as the amount of teachers we have to teach the teachers.
Right.
So that's why, you know, we're constantly fundraising right now to try and get enough funds that we can hire, because right now we have more requests that we can fulfill. And that is a bad place to be. You know, that really makes me very frustrated because everybody wants this thing. You know, and we only have so many teachers that can teach it. So we're trying to expand as fast as we can. That's a good example. I mean, the entire state of Connecticut is ready to do this. But we need a bunch more teachers to teach the teachers, you know.
We'll get there. Wasn't there a panel that you did this past weekend on Teach Rock?
Yeah. That was a fundraiser. We did a panel discussion of the book, and then Bruce interviewed me, and that's gonna be online, I think, in a month or two, and that'll, you know, raise additional funds. But we need some serious big funders to come in and really expand this thing now that we know it works. The pilot programs are done. I mean, we're well on our way. So it's just a matter of how fast can we expand this thing.
Well, as far as boots on the ground goes, how can parents and educators get involved?
Well, they can go to teachrock.org and /discover, which gives you a little bit of shows you what we're doing, or teachrock.org/donate. If they can afford to contribute something, that's always welcome. But we keep it free. We keep it free for teachers. I mean, and parents at home. I mean, it came in really handy during the quarantine. I mean,
right.
Because parents enjoy these lesson plans as much as the kids do. And so, you know, they were able to, you know, basically homeschool during that entire time with our lesson plans. And
if they have any kind of a record library, there's your extracurriculars right there.
Well, yeah, they can do all the research they want on many, many different subjects. But we get them started. You know, we have certain music and video already licensed for them, so you know they don't have to start from scratch. We'll get them started. But once you get into whatever the subject may be, you know, it's folk rock or whether it's hip hop or whatever, you know, there's just hundreds and hundreds of things available and It's one of those, you know, ideas that I think time has come. I mean, we just keep ignoring the arts, thinking that, you know, the day of rock solving the world's problems is gone because rock is no longer part of the mainstream. You know, we are in as far as the industry is concerned, we are back to being a cult. We're back to, you know, 1954 at the moment, you know, and maybe we're going to stay there and maybe that's where we belong, you know, although we still are the biggest thing live, thankfully,
yes,
but the art can still change the world. In this regard, you know, as far it may not be as showy and may not be as obvious, you know, as a big concert or something like that, a big Sun City project, but it can change the world by being integrated into the education system, and I'm convinced of this, that this is the future, and this could really really be a true game changer.
Well, speaking of live acts, I have to ask this because I have to ask this. Will you be on the road with that other band this year, not the Disciples of Soul?
I don't think this year, but hopefully for 2022. We'll see. You know, I got some options. You know, I want to get back on TV eventually. I would like to keep the Disciples of Soul together. I mean, 17, 18, and 19 were the three most productive years of my entire life. Two new albums and six album packages, you know, in 3 years was really, really a nice bit of output. But if Bruce wants to tour, I'm going to give him first priority, you know, obviously. You know, we, you know, if he wants to go out with the E Street Band, we will do that in 22. You know, we do have that album we did right before the quarantine, which is itching to be played live.
Well, we look forward to seeing you on the road, whether it's with the Disciples of Soul or with the E Street Band. Steve Van Zandt, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
My pleasure, Carrie. Good talking to you.